From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The Democratic Convention begins Monday, but early last week, news crews were already littering the parking lots and back alleys of Beantown. CNN's Judy Woodruff got there ahead of the pack and had to strain to fill her show with folksy tours of the USS Constitution. But Fox and MSNBC personalities were just behind. And now the stage is set for convention specials, the likes of which we've never seen before. Or so they tell us. With broadcast coverage pared to the bone, all three major networks are down to 3 hours of coverage each per convention, the cable channels have gone wild with self-promotion. Of course, it's all about self-promotion for the Democrats, too, an opportunity to roll out the party's stars and showcase their candidate in a stage production scripted to the last detail. For the party, coverage is great, but the last thing it wants to make is news.
And chances are it will succeed in making sure nothing really newsworthy happens. That's why the Boston Globe, which wants to be the convention paper of record, will be hedging its bets with a two-page insert covering the coverage. But if there's nothing to report from the podium, how about the after parties? MSNBC's got that covered. Joe Scarborough will be crashing every shindig with Ron Reagan in tow. Meanwhile, the band of cable all-stars, including Greta Van Susteren, Wolf Blitzer, and Chris Matthews, will be interviewing minor players in and around the main events. And if cable can't make this must-see TV, no one can, because no one has more practice filling the airwaves with stuff. But now a brand new class of people with pencils will be crowding the reporters on the convention floor. This year, for the first time, there's bloggers. Jim Zaroli reports.
In many ways, Byron LeMasters is no different than any of the other 15,000 people accredited to cover the Democratic convention in Boston next week. But he may be one of the only ones whose parents are paying for his trip.
They're, I think, going to pay for the ticket and the hotel room, and I think I have to cover expenses, just food and, you know, that kind of stuff. I'm working part-time this summer, so I have some spending money, and I've saved a little bit. And there's always credit cards.
LeMasters is a student at the University of Texas who recently started his own political weblog called BurntOrangeReport.com. He's already learned a thing or two about the power of the press. Governor Rick Perry supposedly complained to a reporter that the site was spreading rumors about his marriage.
I think that was when we kind of woke up and realized, wow, people take us seriously now. So we have some responsibility here, I guess, to think about what we post.
LeMasters loves politics, so when the Democratic convention said it would give press credentials to bloggers, he applied. Now at the age of 21, he'll be roaming the convention floor, rubbing shoulders with longtime political analysts such as David Broder and Ron Brownstein. Convention spokeswoman Peggy Wilhide says LeMasters was one of about 200 bloggers to apply for credentials. Some 30 were accepted.
We looked for people who wrote their own content on their site and didn't just merely post other people's content. We looked at the professionalism of their blog, what their blog looked like, and we looked at their readership or viewership or bloggership, however you want to describe it.
Wilhide says the party decided to invite bloggers because it was clear they've become an important source of information for many people. To Jay Rosen, the chair of the New York University Journalism Department, the presence of bloggers at the two major conventions this year is historically significant, but not unusual.
It's just another expansion of who the press is. Certainly that happened when television reporters came knocking on the doors, and radio reporters and wire services and all kinds. You know, the press has always been expanding.
Rosen is more than a neutral observer here. He's got his own blog where he writes about politics and the media, and he'll be covering the convention too. But as Rosen is the first to acknowledge, it's very much unclear just where bloggers will fit into convention journalism. Almost by definition, most bloggers work independently, without editors, and without necessarily adhering to any journalism code of ethics. Alex Jones of the Kennedy School of Government wrote in the Los Angeles Times recently that he fears bloggers could add more sizzle than steak to the convention. This year, the House of Representatives Press Gallery, which accredits most convention reporters, begged off any involvement with bloggers, leaving it up to the parties themselves. USA Today reporter Jim Drinkard heads the Standing Committee of Journalists that oversees the Congressional Press Gallery. He says committee members don't yet know what to make of blogging.
I guess the fact that it's a new medium, a new vehicle, is one element. Whether the medium is in any way the message is another, you know, and how do we evaluate that? How do we say this is or is not journalism?
In fact, many bloggers, like Byron LeMasters, make no claim to being journalists at all.
I think a lot of us really come at this with the perspective as a political activist who's really just excited about this and want to help get Democrats elected.
LeMasters says he's not afraid to criticize the Democratic Party, but he makes no pretense of journalistic objectivity. He himself is a former Howard Dean supporter. One of the other contributors to LeMasters' site is actually a convention delegate, and many state and local parties have created blogs of their own. The question of how deep the ties go between bloggers and the party has already generated some controversy. Last month, Democratic convention officials disinvited some bloggers who'd already been credentialed. Convention spokeswoman Peggy Wilhide.
We accidentally sent out letters saying yes to 20 more people than we had room for, so we had to rescind those, and it was an unfortunate mistake.
But the incident generated complaints from some bloggers that they were being blacklisted because they were too conservative. Jay Rosen of NYU, who looked into the matter, says he thinks party officials are probably telling the truth. For one thing, some liberal bloggers were also disinvited. Rosen also says whether bloggers are journalists or activists, they can bring something new to the convention.
I don't know exactly what these web bloggers are going to do. They may do nothing special at all and add nothing. But coming with a naive view, coming with just a fresh view, coming without some of the convictions and even some of the cynicism of a professional reporter might itself be good.
As Byron LeMaster sees it, many political journalists see covering the conventions as a job, and they're bored. Everything is scripted and choreographed ahead of time. All of the major decisions have already been made.
But what I think bloggers bring that's a different perspective is that we're really genuinely enthusiastic about being there. We're excited to cover it, and I think we're going to cover different aspects that may not be reached by sort of the more mainstream media.
LeMaster says that means giving more attention to the views of delegates and to the candidates' policies. In that sense, the bloggers' status as outsiders, people who challenge traditional media paradigms, could also be what makes them most interesting. For On the Media, this is Jim Zaroli.
For years, this program has piled on Fox News as being the very antithesis of its slogan, fair and balanced. But even we are surprised at how potent an issue Fox has become for the left in this political race. Now MoveOn and Common Cause have filed a complaint with the Federal Trade Commission to strip Fox News of its fair and balanced slogan on the grounds that it is, in effect, false advertising. And the liberal online news service Alternet already has a similar case pending with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. These are most likely symbolic gestures, but why make them? We thought we'd put the question to Paul Maslin, Democratic pollster and former advisor to candidate Howard Dean.
I think it's the latest manifestation of an entire sort of reawakening of progressives, Democrats, liberals to fight back in many ways. And I think it started really in the aftermath of the 2000 election. People thought that election was unfair, the outcome was unfair. But it's tough to go after 9 justices in a Supreme Court. It's tough to do it electorally when those choices only come up intermittently. The media's in your face all the time. I think the war was really the key moment in all of this, because not only was there frustration about the policy to begin with, but I think the coverage of the war itself, there was a feeling that the media was sanitizing things or glorifying things in a way that made progressives feel that their dissent was not going to be heard, that there wasn't going to be a different version of this story.
The media used to be the hobby horse of the right. Ever since Spiro Agnew denounced the press as nattering nabobs of negativism back in 1970, and the left has been mostly on the defensive, denying that there is a liberal media establishment.
They're borrowing the tactics that the right wing has used for years, and why not? Turnabout is fair play. The right not only have political control, but they have working control of a lot of the media outlets in this country right now. And if not control, they certainly have influence. So their complaint now seems pretty hollow after all this time. And for once, our side of the equation is saying, hey, wait a minute, let's look at the real facts here.
I know that the coverage of the war and in the aftermath of 9/11 was not all that it could have been or should have been. But are you really suggesting that mainstream media is now in the pocket of conservatives?
I'm suggesting that the natural pack journalism added to the market pressures that have been created in the, what I would call the television tabloid era that we're now in, led people to be more reluctant to question, in this case, a conservative and Republican administration, or to question a war. I'm not saying that conservatives are necessarily in charge, but I am saying that coverage has been slanted in the last couple of years, and I think it's not surprising that you see a counterreaction to that.
So then you think Fox is basically providing progressives with a foothold in a larger campaign against the mainstream media?
Absolutely. Just in the way that CBS seemed, or NPR for that matter, or PBS seemed to do that for the right wing for many years. They weren't simply going after CBS, but they were going after something bigger. And let's not discount what the motivation is here. The motivation is really threefold, I would say. Number one, to achieve political change. That may happen this year. Secondly, to grow and sustain your own movement. You feed your masses. And if the masses want to hear this and the masses are emboldened by this, they'll give you more money. They'll give you another $100 over the internet. And third is to change the actual policy of the media itself. That's going to be the most fascinating story here.
Thomas Mann, a political expert at the Brookings Institution, told the Wall Street Journal that this is not a galvanizing issue for the masses, that this is an elite political argument. Do you have any evidence to support your contention that people give a rat's bottom about media consolidation?
Well, the best evidence I can give you is within the Democratic primaries, which, yes, that's not the entire country, but it's certainly a big slice of the country. When Howard Dean, who I was then working for, mentioned at one point in the course of a bigger discussion about deregulation that maybe people ought to look at the consolidation of media outlets in this country and whether that's good or bad, we subsequently polled and found that the response was overwhelming. And I've seen in other polls that this is not something that is limited to just liberals or Democrats. In fact, it's one of the aspects that actually unites people from different ideological spectra, the fact that they think that media control is in the hands of too few people now. It's going to frustrate people on all ends of the spectrum who think that, you know, they're an average person and their story basically is not being heard. And so I disagree. I think actually there is a lot of potency to this issue, and maybe more in the years to come even than we're seeing this year.
Okay. Paul, thanks very much.
Quite welcome.
Paul Maslin is a political consultant who has worked for dozens of Democratic politicians, most recently presidential candidate Howard Dean.
Coming up, a primal scream from the Voice of America and how to get the rest of the world to buy what America is selling.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The Voice of America is getting hoarse. Its employees disgruntled. Its mission, they say, muddled. This month, about half of VOA's 1,000 staffers petitioned Congress, charging the Broadcasting Board of Governors, appointed by the president, with killing The Voice. The Broadcasting Board was created in the 90s to serve as editorial firewall between the government and VOA's journalists. Since 9/11, the board has slashed the English language broadcast hours and abolished several foreign language services, including the Arabic service. Instead, it's plowed millions of dollars into youth-oriented, entertainment-driven programs in what many staffers see as a misguided effort to win hearts and minds in the Middle East.
How on earth, they wonder, did the VOA go from this
Sayyidati wa sadati, assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah,
to this? That's Radio Sawa.
They eliminated the Voice of America Arabic service and replaced it with a top 40 format.
Tim Shamble is a radio production specialist at the VOA.
In the Middle East, you have mullahs telling young kids that it's okay to strap bombs around your waist, blow yourself up, and murder innocent people. By us playing Britney Spears, you're not counteracting that.
Now, as much as I liked old Tim, that just doesn't make any sense.
Ken Tomlinson, a former director of VOA, now is the head of the President's Broadcasting Board of Governors.
You use music to attract audiences for news and information.
He ushered in the creation not only of Radio Sawa, but also Al Hurra, an Arabic language satellite TV network.
We were able to get Al Hurra television on the air in a matter of months. If we'd waited for VOA to do it with its civil service regulations and union rules, it would have taken years. The war against terror is now.
Ken, what was wrong with the way VOA was doing its job before?
Well, in the first place, they were using shortwave, to a part of the world where shortwave is yesterday. In the second place, it was slow and stodgy. It was not oriented to attract a younger audience. It wasn't with it, as it were.
What do you say to the argument that the service was underfunded? It was costing only $4 million. Rather than update it and put money into that, it killed it and launched Radio Sawa, which cost $36 million.
VOA has always been underfunded, but the VOA leadership did not have the foresight to develop a plan for a youth-oriented radio station like this, just like the leadership of VOA in the 1990s remained stuck in the shortwave model as opposed to moving to the future of satellite television.
Let's talk about Al Hara. That cost about 100 million U.S. tax dollars to launch. And on Al Hara, the petition asserts, the assassination of Hamas leader Sheikh Yassin was basically not reported when it happened. It aired a French cooking show instead. A major bomb attack in Baghdad was not reported. The station stayed with a Jim Carrey documentary. U.S. attacks on insurgents in Fallujah. Again, it stayed with pre-recorded programming. In other words, not very responsive to the news that the Iraqis care about.
Out of context in the early days of Al Hura. In each of those cases, you're talking about not being reported 1 hour, but being fully reported within a couple of hours. If that happened today, we'd be interrupting the program instantly.
Point taken. But I still have to wonder, why was Al Hara ever, in these troubled times, airing a French cooking show, a Jim Carrey documentary, the actor's studio program?
Well, in the first place, I wish we had had for the launch the 100 million you talked about. We didn't have that much. It takes a lot of money to do all news television. We fortunately, in the new appropriations bill, are going to have more money, and we're going to apply that money to news coverage. But on the other hand, one of the reasons to have a television service like this is to give the people of the Middle East a sense of what's happening elsewhere in the world. And American film is an important aspect of what we export.
It's been commonly observed, however, that just because young Arabic men and women like Britney Spears, it isn't going to make them like America. And that seems to be the driving force behind some of the programming decisions that are made, especially on Radio Sawa.
Only on Radio Sawa. We don't have music on Al Hura. But look, the music that I enjoy is not the music my sons enjoy. If we want to attract a younger audience, we better play music that attracts that younger audience. Voice of America, throughout its history, has used music to attract audiences. In the 1940s and 50s, we used jazz and some of the same kinds of people who complain about the popular rock music we are using now on Sawa complained about jazz in the 1940s.
But on Radio Sawa, where you're using music to attract an audience, you're not really providing them with news and information, I think, by any standard that the VOA might apply.
25% of Sawa is news and current affairs. There are very thoughtful, lengthy current affairs shows that, frankly, rival what we have on NPR.
We have spoken to critics of Al Hara in Iraq who say that there is very little on that station and Radio Sawa with regard to news that they can use that actually informs their lives.
Well, as you well know, critics of news can be difficult to satisfy. Look at the critics of NPR's coverage in the Middle East. I do not speak Arabic, but I talk to others who do know Arabic, and they think the journalism of Al Hura is top-notch, but it's news is tough to judge.
Okay. Ken Tomlinson, thank you very much.
Great to talk to you.
Ken Tomlinson is chairman of the Broadcasting Board of Directors and also the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which has given support to NPR, WNYC, and this program. Myrna Whitworth is a 28-year veteran of VOA and has on three separate occasions filled in as head of that agency.
I was acting director on September 11th, 2001, and I must say I was very proud of the way VOA reacted immediately in terms of adding programming in Arabic, adding programming in our two languages to Afghanistan, Pashto and Dari. We went on the air 24 hours a day with an all-news format. And we were broadcasting at the time in 54 languages. VOA now only broadcasts in 44. But on the 20th of September, we had an opportunity to interview Mullah Omar, the leader of Afghanistan at the time. He was head of the Taliban. Mullah Omar listened to VOA every day. I think it's important for people to understand that at the time, Voice of America was listened to by approximately 80% of the male population of Afghanistan. And we did an interview with him.
You didn't run it uncut. You edited it.
Oh, drastically. In fact, I think it turned out to be like 22 seconds.
And yet you got an avalanche of criticism.
Well, it created a firestorm. Very high-level officials, both the State Department and the National Security Council, phoned members of the Broadcasting Board of Governors, arguing that this should not be aired in any form. Many people said that we were giving a voice to terrorists. Shortly after the report was aired, I was removed as acting director and replaced by a gentleman who had strong ties to the National Security Council, and the head of our Pashto service was removed and given a rather menial position.
Well, what do you think the value was of broadcasting Mullah Omar?
News organizations around the world were trying to get Mullah Omar, and the Voice of America got him. That, in a sense, was news itself. And I think we showed who he was, both to his countrymen and to the world. And we put what he was saying in context. All that we can do as a legitimate news organization is provide the information and hope that by providing objective and accurate information that our audience is able to make reasoned decisions and conclusions. And that, I believe, is our role.
And is that currently, do you believe, the role of VOA?
I think that's what VOA should be, and I think that the majority of those people who signed the petition recently fear that it's becoming not the case. What they're saying is that content is very important, and the American taxpayer is not spending the, you know, $500 million a year for international broadcasting to play music.
You're talking about Radio Sawa?
Radio Sawa, yes.
Well, what do you think about the notion that America needs to be pouring its resources into winning the hearts and minds of young people throughout the Arab world, and that the way to do that is to program less talk and more pop music and features?
The audiences in the Middle East can get music. They don't need the Voice of America to get their music. It's very easy to get a DJ and get a bunch of Western pop music and Arabic pop music with headline type of news and put it on the air. And there's some question about how much of the headline news is actually listened to by that young audience.
Ken Tomlinson told us that 25% of Radio Sawa's programming is news and information.
That may be true, but nobody knows. The Broadcasting Board of Governors requires that every one of its language services under its purview, from VOA, from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Radio Free Asia, have an annual review of content analysis. Since Radio Sawa began 26 months ago, it has never undergone that review.
He says that Radio Sawa is undergoing a review right now, as a matter of fact.
Well, I think we're all going to be very interested to see what the results are.
Myrna, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Myrna Whitworth is the former acting director of The Voice of America.
In a March poll by the Pew Center for People in the Press, 62% of Frenchmen declared disapproval of the United States. So did 93% of Jordanians and 34% of Britons. Anybody who still asks, why do they hate us, just isn't paying attention. And anybody who replies they hate our freedoms isn't looking at the data. 70% of Germans, according to the Pew poll, are less confident that the U.S. wishes to promote democracy. 66% of Turks believe U.S. leaders lied about the Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. 63% of Moroccans believe America's motives are to control Mideast oil. So the question is, if the great Satan is so damned unpopular, why exactly are the Golden Arches going gangbusters? McDonald's grew more than 5% overseas so far this year. Coca-Cola is growing. Jack Daniels and MTV are growing. Marlboro, in spite of worldwide anti-tobacco legislation, is growing. It would seem to be a paradox. American products embraced and beloved, while America, the product, is met with contempt. In spearheading his magazine's annual brand survey, Business Week's senior editor Jerry Kermush expected to see a backlash of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the war on Iraq against America's commercial icons. What he found instead was ambivalence writ large.
We had bureau reporters in places like India who'd seen examples of people demonstrating against America, burning American flags in front of the embassy for the TV cameras. And once it was all over, they went down the street to McDonald's and had lunch.
Look at the Palestinians throwing rocks against Israelis. The way they are dressed, jeans, and often T-shirts that have Disney characters on their chests.
Ahmed Ali Abougait is permanent representative to the United Nations from Egypt, where consumers have no difficulty compartmentalizing the American lifestyle they envy and the American politics they despise.
Yes, they objected to the war in Iraq. However, they maintained their liking to whatever that is still American, from McDonald's to Pizza Hut to American cars to American music, American films.
No, that wasn't Dick Cheney. It was Leonardo DiCaprio in Titanic, one of the most successful American exports of all time, raking in more than $1.2 billion in box office overseas. After the invasion of Iraq, Hollywood braced for a collision with an iceberg of anti-Americanism, because not only is Hollywood quintessentially American, it is also notoriously the vector for our alleged decadence, spiritual emptiness, and moral depravity. But the catastrophic collision of foreign cultures and U.S. pop culture never came.
Actually, the box office abroad has held up extremely well. In fact, it seems to be on the increase.
Elizabeth Guider is deputy editor of Variety magazine.
Anywhere from 60 to 80% of the entire box office, say, in Italy, is American movies, not Italian movies. In Indonesia, the most popular shows at the moment are Fear Factor and Survivor.
So, yeah, Fear Factor is very well received. This wasn't.
My name is Farouk Muhammad. I'm a paramedic for the Fire Department of New York. I have co-workers who are Jewish, who are Christian, Catholic, Hindu even, all different faiths.
Though the State Department insists the campaign's message of America as a hospitable environment for Muslims jimmied open doors of understanding, it was widely ridiculed in the Arab press and quickly pulled off the air. But is it really evidence of that mysterious paradox, or is it just a question of overestimating the power of advertising? Keith Reinhardt is chairman of the ad agency DDB Worldwide.
No amount of advertising would ever be able to sell a product which hasn't been carefully designed for the intended audience. The first step is listening very carefully through all the research we can gather so that we know what it is about the product we should promote, what it is we should change, and how we should conduct ourselves. We should certainly never start with the advertising step.
After all, for all the glitzy ad campaigns, nobody ever bought the Edsel, the Newton, or Touch of Yogurt shampoo. At the moment, rightly or wrongly, American foreign policy is an Edsel, and neither a series of State Department videos nor such American-produced media as Radio Sawa are going to change that. American business has taken note of the government's failure to win hearts and minds and is taking it upon itself to revitalize brand America its own way. Ad exec Keith Reinhardt also heads the Business for Diplomatic Action initiative.
It's about action. U.S. business could organize a collective intern program. Once young people come and actually live here, they are changed forever as they go back to their home states. Listening programs, youths listening to one another online, possibly in a McDonald's or a Starbucks. The idea of Americans listening to the world.
MTV, for one, is listening. The Viacom cable network has created 94 music channels around the world in the image of the local cultures, a a colorful, comical Bollywood take in India, high-tech everything in Japan, and in Indonesia, five times daily, a call to prayer.
You can fragment the American brand experience into a thousand pieces, but the fundamental basis of it would have to do with the rule of law, the belief in freedom, the opportunities for the individual.
Charlotte Beers, for all her difficulties in her brief tenure as Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy, also still believes the greatest opportunity is to mine that core for the hope it still represents.
America is one of the most complex and fascinating brands I've ever met.
Some bridle at the very notion of America, the brand. But a brand, by definition, is not an accumulation of hype. It is the accumulation of core values and benefits, both intrinsic and perceived. The challenge facing the State Department and the nation at large is to persuade a skeptical world that brand America is new and improved.
We first broadcast Bob's piece back in March. Up next, how to succeed in snooping without really trying all that hard, and when it's okay to talk back to the big screen.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. 2 weeks ago, computer junkies from around the world descended on Midtown Manhattan for the Fifth Hope Convention. That stands for Hackers on Planet Earth. Punching away at laptop keyboards, they got inspiration, advice, and yes, hacking tips, and workshops with titles like How to Break Anonymity Networks. Stephen Rombam is a private investigator who makes heavy use of online databases to earn his living. He spoke at the Hope Convention, and he joins me now. Stephen, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
So you gave a talk at the Hackers Convention titled Privacy is Dead, Get Over It. First off, how and when did privacy die, and why should I get over it? I like my privacy.
Well, privacy died sometime in the early 80s when everything in the world of information that was newly created or recompiled began to be put into databases. And once that started, that information never went away. There is nothing in your day-to-day life that occurs that is not cataloged.
Well, who generates these databases, and how do they find these things out?
These are not governmental Big Brother databases. These are databases compiled rather by, let's say, little cousin. Every type of private industry that feels that they have a need to catalog this sort of information on you. And most of them do have a legitimate need.
Now, we know that government has restrictions on the way that it can compile and use data, but there aren't similar restrictions on business.
Unfortunately, the government is using these lack of restrictions on private industry to do an end run around everything from congressional oversight to the Freedom of Information Act to privacy restrictions that have been enacted into law to prevent the government from compiling these databases. What the government does is it pays private industry to compile these databases. What you buy in stores, what you read, what your political affiliations are, what your finances are, where you travel, what you drive. It then accesses these databases, which are at that point considered private databases. And when people ask to regulate them, the same governmental agency that pays for them and uses them says, sorry, they're private databases. We can't control them.
How is the government allowed to do that? Is it because it isn't doing it itself but paying a third party?
That's correct. This is the most cynical avoidance I've ever seen of oversight and regulation.
Stephen, you're totally creeping me out.
Even more frightening is that if you go on the internet and you type in cellular telephone bills into Google, you will find dozens of people offering to sell you someone's cellular telephone bills openly on the internet. And by the way, it is at best a misdemeanor to do so, in most cases a felony, and nobody's shutting these guys down.
Okay, I hope I don't regret this. One day ago, one of my producers gave you my name, just my name, and no money, and told you to dig up some information on me. So what did you find?
Oh, my gosh. First of all, you actually live not that far from me in Brooklyn. Should I read off your Social Security number?
No, definitely not.
As far as your house goes, your deed, your mortgage, the power of attorney that your husband signed over to you when you bought the house in 95.
Wow.
The name of the gentleman that you bought the home from. He was apparently some sort of official of the St. Charbel Maronite Catholic Church. Should I say how much you paid for your home?
Nah.
The only thing that caused me a little problem is I was trying to figure out who Stacy was. But I figured out she's not your daughter because the date of birth is so close. It must be your sister?
Yeah.
Okay. I have your addresses in Cathedral City, California, Washington, D.C., Stamford, Brooklyn, another one in Washington, Palo Alto. I do know that you lived in Russia. I mean, obviously, we didn't have much chance to do an investigation. I slapped this together in about 10 minutes this morning.
Wow. If we'd given you a week or two, what else could you have found?
We would have gotten your credit card bills. We would have gotten your phone bills. We would have gone back at least 6 months. We would have found out everything you bought to read, everything you bought to eat if you use your credit card, everywhere you traveled, everyone you spoke to on the phone. We would have found out where you vote, who you voted for with some reasonable degree of certainty. Your affiliation is recorded in New York.
Mm-hmm.
About two-thirds of what I just mentioned would be unequivocally illegal if I didn't receive your release. But nevertheless, it's done every day.
Well, Stephen, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
And by the way, Stephen?
Yep.
Consider that release to investigate me lapsed.
Not a problem. I do have a shredder.
Stephen Rambam is a private investigator.
Some of us, alas, have a particular challenge safeguarding our personal information. We are the universe of media junkies, and I think you know the problem. Somebody forwards you a story from a major newspaper. You click on the link. The page opens up. But before you can read the story, you need to answer some basic but increasingly irritating questions. Your zip code, gender, age, stuff like that. Faced with such a form, you have four options. One, don't read the article. In other words, just don't use sites that require registration. Or two, go to the newsstand and buy the paper version of the paper. Nobody will bother you for your gender or zip code. Three, lie. Just put in any name or any age, any zip code. Finally, there's four. You can use a number of additional internet resources that help you get around the system. Rachel Metz reported on a few of these resources for Wired News. Rachel, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you. Hi.
Why do websites need this registration information in the first place? I gather it's simply the price we pay for accessing otherwise free material.
The people that I spoke to do see it to a certain extent as sort of a trade-off for offering free information. As a writer myself, I know that the content on the sites doesn't just magically appear. Someone has to write it, and you know it costs money to do that. They can use registration information to show advertisers, hey, we have this number of readers in this demographic, so you should put ads on our website.
Well, tell me about BugMeNot.com, because it's a fascinating enterprise.
BugMeNot.com is a website that people can use if they want to read websites that require, newspaper websites that require registration, such as the LA Times Online, New York Times, Washington Post, that kind of thing. You can go to bugmenot.com and type in the URL, say nytimes.com, and it'll give you a login name and a password that you can use. These are submitted by users of the website, so you can make up an ID on a website like latimes.com and then submit it to BugMeNot so other people can use it.
So it's kind of like file sharing only with logons and passwords.
Kind of, yeah. And it's only for websites that require registration, but the content is essentially free. So they wouldn't allow you to perpetuate login information for websites that charge users say like salon.com.
These sites are free, but in effect, they're not really free because your personal information is a commodity that the owners of the sites are using to attract advertising and so forth. So if you're depriving the site of your demographic information, aren't you, in effect, stealing?
I'm not really sure if people that are doing that would consider it stealing, because if you're giving them your accurate information, a lot of people feel like that's giving up something that they shouldn't be having to give up to read about what's happening.
Well, I don't think I should pay the exorbitant prices at Cartier for a diamond necklace, but that doesn't give me license to smash the glass and just take it.
Mm-hmm.
You're at liberty to use the site or not. There's an asking price, and if you don't wish to pay it, don't pay it.
Yeah. You know, whether or not it's something that people see as right or wrong, my talking with different people that work on the newspaper end actually aren't very concerned about this phenomenon. That did surprise me, but it seems like from their end, it's not really seen as a big deal at all. My impression is that the newspapers are pretty confident that the information they are getting is by and large good data. And so having a few people trying to circumvent that is really not a big problem.
It's a strange and wonderful e-frontier.
Sure.
Rachel, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Rachel Metz's story, We Don't Need No Stinkin' Login, is available at wired.com. Hey, Rachel, will listeners need to register to read your story?
No, they will not. They can just go to wired.com and look it up.
Very good. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you.
This weekend, the Rocky Horror Picture Show Fan Club gathers for its annual convention in New York City. Few films can claim Rocky Horror's cult pedigree, but that doesn't mean they don't try. OTM's Derek John reports on the horrors wrought by Rocky.
The weekly Saturday midnight spectacle that is the Rocky Horror Picture Show is as reliable as a Sunday morning church service. As the crowd at New York's Chelsea Clearview Cinema alternates between jeers and cheers, costumed audience members act in sync with the action on the screen. As insults are slung, puns are punned, and rice is thrown, it's not hard to see why the Rocky Horror cult movie experience never worked as an afternoon matinee.
Movies were definitely released at midnight to find a certain audience, you know, wouldn't have to get up to go to work the next day.
Jim Hoberman, senior film critic at the Village Voice and co-author of the 1982 book Midnight Movies, was one of the earliest observers of the cult movie scene.
There was this sense of a shared experience. You know, these movies were participatory in a way, culminating, of course, in the Rocky Horror Picture Show. And they projected scenarios which would appeal to what was left of the counterculture in the 70s, after its decline as a political force in American society.
Through repeated midnight viewings, films like John Waters' Pink Flamingos and David Lynch's Eraserhead flew under the mainstream radar and developed into word-of-mouth cult sensations. But as the counterculture faded and technology became more portable, midnight movies flickered and were forced to change. The midnight movies that play well today reflect a generation weaned on the VCR. Mark Vallon programs midnight movies for Landmark Theaters, the nation's largest art house chain.
The audience has gotten younger for the midnight series, but a lot of the more popular films of the midnight series these days are films from the 80s, early 90s. Maybe they've only seen the film on video or DVD and want that movie experience. It becomes like a party sometimes.
Movieoki. If there's one word that captures this new generation's cult movie habits, it's got to be movieoki. Yep, and it's exactly what it sounds like. In this case, Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Bring down the holy hand grenade! Let's put this down, miss. Blow on enemies to tiny bits.
Crammed into the basement of New York's Two Boots Pioneer Theater, the Den of Sin, that sin is in cinema, finds fresh-faced film fanatics acting out their favorite movie dialogue in front of an 8-foot-tall DVD projection screen. The Pioneer, a smallish 100-seat movie house affixed to a pizzeria, looks and feels like a cinematic throwback. It's two workhorse 35mm projectors, salvaged from the East German consulate after the fall of the Berlin Wall, show midnight movies every weekend, giving the theater a charm that the multiplexes lack. The Pioneer recently served as midwife to Donnie Darko, a latter-day challenger to the Rocky Horror Picture Show's cult movie Throne.
We were like a little bit surprised that it could show for almost 2 years, two plus, I guess, and people would still want to come see it and see it repeatedly, you know, over and over.
Doris Cornish, co-owner of the Two Boots Pioneer Theater, had the foresight to schedule Donnie Darko at midnight before anyone else did.
This film had something that touched people's hearts and minds, like, all at the same time, and hit those nerves that a lot of films, you know, miss these days.
Donnie Darko. What the hell kind of name is that? It's like some sort of superhero or something.
What makes you think I'm not?
From the beginning, this first feature by 26-year-old director Richard Kelly defied easy categorization. And it was deemed controversial when it first opened 2 months after September 11th, 2001.
Well, there's a scene in the film where a jet engine crashes through Donnie Darko's house.
Bo Kalin is promotions manager for Baxter Avenue Theaters in Louisville, Kentucky. Like other locally owned movie houses across the country, the Baxter started running Donnie Darko at midnight after its DVD sales went through the roof.
When we first announced that we were getting Donnie Darko, everyone was excited because that was a film that never got to the Louisville scene. I recall we sold out all 450 seats we had several hours before the film was actually scheduled to play.
The idea that a cult film's popularity in the living room might propel it back into a theater wasn't obvious at first. In fact, when videos were first introduced in the late 70s, they undercut the theaters that incubated midnight movies. Village Voice film critic Jim Hoberman.
On the other hand, it made it kind of easier for people to really seriously fetishize movies and turn them into cult objects, because they could have the movie and they could look at it as often as they wanted to at home. So I think as a result of that, new cults were born.
Jim Hoberman credits Donnie Darko's cryptic website with helping create an online buzz similar to the Blair Witch Project in 1999.
The website augmented the mythology of the film so that people not only saw the movie, they could read about it on the website, and it became a form of knowledge.
And the movie industry has started paying attention. Donnie Darko's success on DVD and as a midnight cult film has led to its mainstream re-release in select theaters this weekend. Film critics increasingly rechristen former box office flops and DVD reissues as overlooked cult classics. And some in Hollywood have begun hyping their DVD's alleged midnight movie potential. Landmark Theater's Mark Vallon.
A couple of the studios have gotten savvy to the idea that there are certain films, when they're making a DVD release, that either has a certain cult director or somebody attached to it that they realized if they made a print of the film for theatrical, that they could probably get some playdates.
But as midnight movie promoter Bo Kalin has learned, no matter how you try to package the cult movie experience, there are some things you just can't put on the DVD.
The staff would ask me if they could dress up when we had Fight Club and Pink Flamingos in the same night. And a couple of them said, oh, can, you know, we wander around, you know, shirtless too, like we just got in a fight. I was like, well, if you want to wander around shirtless in a lobby full of people here to see Pink Flamingos, far be it for me to stop you.
For On the Media, I'm Derek John.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was directed by Katya Rogers and produced by Janine Price, Megan Ryan, and Tony Field, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Mike Vuolo and Ann Kossoff, and editing help from Sharon Ball. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts and MP3 downloads at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. And the National Endowment for the Arts. Support from the media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.